How do we get justice? Dear Lily, in most societies, the last thing a person wants to do is to go anywhere near a court of law. A lot of money is wasted, and you may lose. So if you want to sort out a quarrel, you get your brothers to smash up the other person's house or seize their property. Or, in a Nepalese village, you ask some senior villagers to come and settle the quarrel in a relaxed way, sitting on the veranda among the grain baskets and chickens. Are English and American courts odd? Law is a strange process, which in many ways goes against the grain of ordinary life. A court is basically a place where people behave in an odd way. They bring their disputes to a complete stranger who, after listening and asking questions, says one is in the right and the other is in the wrong. If going to court is a strange thing to do, going to an English or American court is an extreme form of this peculiarity. You are asked to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. In most societies, there is no belief that there is an abstract thing called truth. There are believed to be many conflicting types of truth: factual, social, religious, mythical. Each is true in a different way. Furthermore, no one but a lunatic or a traitor would tell the court something that would hurt their family or friends. People are expected to lie, or at least to tell partial truths. When you are judged in an English court, it is by a curious standard. The ultimate test in the mind of the jury or judge, both of whether your story is true and of whether you have done something wrong, is to ask themselves, was this the behavior of a reasonable man? Man here is a shorthand for everyone: men, women, upper class, lower class. It is assumed that all individuals should and indeed do adhere to the same idea of reasonableness, and that all behaviour can therefore be judged by the same standards. Almost everywhere else, men and women, rich and poor, old and young, are assumed to be reasonable in a very different way. Furthermore, reasonable behaviour is entirely dependent on the social relationship involved. It is reasonable for a man to strike his wife or his son, highly unreasonable for a woman or son to strike back. It is reasonable for an uncle to find a job in his office for his nephew, but not reasonable to find jobs for unrelated people. It is reasonable to pay a bribe to a customs officer or policeman, but not to someone who has no power. Much of law is concerned with deciding about the behaviour of people who are by birth or achieved position unequal. In Anglo-American law, it is about deciding between people who are considered to be on a level, not intrinsically unequal, even if they appear strikingly different in their education, sex, wealth, or race. It is assumed in modern law that individuals have rights: men, women, children, disabled people, even the unborn fetus or animals, all have intrinsic rights. Very few societies in the world share this view. It's usually thought that an individual exists only as part of a group. He or she has rights in relation to others, which are inseparable from responsibilities. There are no innate rights which come with birth. The idea that, in the words of the American Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are intrinsic and inextinguishable human rights, would be regarded by a large part of the world, even today, and certainly over most of history, as an outrageous claim. When the idea was imported into India in the 19th century by the British, it caused immense confusion and disapproval. A member of a lower caste, a woman, a child, had never been conceived of as having the same rights as a high caste person, a man, an adult. This assumption of individual human rights is a very old feature of English law. It has now spread over the world and become a central doctrine of a new form of mission activity. It has many merits. When taken to extremes, without attention to the counterbalancing rights of communities and groups, or the responsibilities that go with the rights, it is as dangerous as rightlessness. How does law rule over us? We often hear about the rule of law, but what does this mean? One idea is that people are prepared to settle disputes through legal process rather than by force. A second is that all actions and all power are ultimately under the law. Above the rulers, there is something higher. They also are under the law. Usually, legal systems develop in a different way. At first, the rulers may say, "We make the laws and we keep the laws." But after a time, they forget the second half of this. They are above the law. So the law does not rule them. They rule the law. You can see this in Stalin's Russia, Chairman Mao's China, or France in the later 17th century. There is one law for the powerful and rich, and another law for the people. Only in England, Scotland has a somewhat different system, for a long period of about 700 years, have we believed that ultimately the law is supreme, and even the king and his ministers have to abide by it. Everybody is under the same rule. Unlike chess, where certain pieces have privileges, the English law gives few privileges, at least in theory. The rule of law depends on uniform application of laws and a common procedure. It means that the legal process should be separated off from the political, that the judges and the courts should be independent. All of this is difficult to sustain. Powerful forces, economic and political, are constantly hoping to bias law in their direction. How do courts work? The great problem is to persuade people to accept what you are doing in the legal process. Law is a dramatic and often elaborate affair. People dress up in archaic costumes. The judge sits high up above the court. Long-sounding words are used in a strangely formal way. There are often dramatic public punishments, as in the so-called theatre off Tyburn, where criminals were taken through the streets and executed before the crowds in 18th century England. The legal process takes people out of their ordinary lives, where they have become entangled in conflicts. It puts them in an arena that is out of normal time and space. The procedure in the court then rearranges their lives. You have to exert a lot of pressure in order to persuade people to follow a decision that they may think is against their interest. So the law is like a game of tennis. People go to a court, they play a combative game, either on their own behalf or through their representatives, serving, returning, trying to outwit their opponents. The judge is the umpire. After the case has been heard, their world is changed. One side has won, the other lost. What are juries? In almost all serious legal cases, you have a confrontation between the state and the citizen or subject. The state has almost all the power, and the single individual is inherently very weak. So if the state says, "You are suspected of an offence," how can you defend yourself? When you have a jury system where it is the duty of your equals or peers to decide your guilt or innocence, everything is changed. The jury are not themselves on trial, but observers and arbiters. It's one thing to grind down a single individual who is already accused of an offence. It is entirely different to be able to persuade 12 free, moderately affluent and reasonably educated individuals who have been told on oath to judge as fairly as possible without fear or favour. So the jury acts as a filter of state power, a protection for the single citizen or subject. It is a key institution in any democracy. Most countries in Western Europe had juries of a sort 1,000 years ago. Yet almost all had given up the jury system by the 18th century. England has maintained a jury system up to the present. There are now increasing calls by politicians for its abolition in a wide range of cases. Should we ever torture people? The absence of the use of torture in criminal trials throughout most of English history is a notable feature of England's legal system. Very early on, the English courts set their face against torture. People believed that if you tortured someone, you would not get a true confession. The tortured person would lie in order to make the torture stop. There was also perhaps a certain appreciation of the force in the philosopher Montaigne's remark that After all, it is setting a very high price on one's conjectures to burn a man alive for them. In English law, you do not need the confession of the accused. You prove them guilty or not on the basis of evidence. It has never mattered what the individuals think after they have been proven guilty. If the jury thinks that you are guilty in the face of the law. You can go to prison or the gallows tree protesting your innocence. That is your right. This tradition of avoiding the short cut of torture is also under threat. Some of those engaged in the war against terror in Britain and America, where torture is currently banned, are now arguing that it should be allowed, or at least the evidence from those tortured by less scrupulous regimes in other countries should be accepted. How unusual is England? The essence of English law is the protection of the individual and his or her rights to a certain amount of liberty, freedom of speech, control of his or her body and personal space, and to everything he or she owns. Ownership includes visible things, like bits of land and houses, but also invisible things, such as intellectual property, and certain things such as the right to a title or office. In most societies, law is concerned mainly with interpersonal matters of status and physical injuries. England, in contrast, has been obsessed with property, with civil law, that is, cases between individuals who use the courts to sort out disputes about who has rights in what. Nowadays, the principles of an old English system have spread through the former British Empire and the United States. They are so widespread that they have become the normal way of proceeding. Many of the fundamental ideas, for instance, the absence of judicial torture, the separation of politics from law, and the rules of evidence, have become enshrined in the European Constitution and elsewhere. This makes it easy to forget that if we had looked around the world in about 1750, we would have been astonished at the English exception. Does the English system have advantages? The sophisticated development of property law and safeguarding of economic interests have helped to make England and America wealthy. People can afford to trust each other, and if that trust breaks down, they can use the legal system. The early development of industrial capitalism could not have occurred without the extraordinary development of English law. The other main advantage of this kind of legal system is that, on the whole, the majority of people feel safe under it. Without a legal warrant from a justice of the peace, the police cannot raid a person's house or business. Most people, most of the time, except asylum seekers and members of some racial minorities, can rest assured that they will not be subjected to arbitrary punishments or imprisonment. If you are arrested, you have the right to call a lawyer and the right to know what you are being charged with, and the right to be freed if no charge is brought within a certain number of hours or days, habeas corpus as it is known. Under the rule of law, an individual is relatively free from censorship of thought and action. Criticism of the authorities, free speech within reason, and reasoned opposition to the present system are all tolerated. Some of these advantages of the rule of law are being whittled away. State officials argue that suspected terrorists and asylum seekers should not be given legal protection, but should be subject to imprisonment without charge or trial for long periods. There are those who now fear that once certain categories of person are denied legal protection, it will not be too long before we will be in the nightmare world of Stalin. Are there disadvantages to the system? People complain about the slowness, the cost, the complexity, and at times inefficiency of the English system. There is something in the satirist Jonathan Swift's observation that laws are like cobwebs, which may catch small flies, but let wasps and hornets break through. It is sometimes impossible to convict someone who is clearly guilty. The inquisitorial system, where the judge can call for more investigation, might well avoid some of these difficulties. Yet the main disadvantage of the English system is that it can generate an antagonistic attitude. Much of the English practice of politics and social life, including sports, is confrontational. The English legal system is odd because it believes, or pretends to believe, that disputes are resolvable into one person's winning, being right, and the other's losing, being wrong. If this is accepted, then the best way to sort out difficulties is to get those in the dispute to carry out as fierce an argument as possible in front of a referee or umpire. In divorce, for instance, a confrontational legal system can lead to much bitterness. The people who profit most from this are the lawyers, who sometimes have a vested interest in dragging the case out. There is much in life where right is evenly divided and where mediation or arbitration, poorly developed in the English legal system, is a much better approach to settlement. In a Nepalese village I know, all quarrels are settled outside the court. And in Japan, nearly everything is done through mediation or arbitration. The aim of the Anglo-American system is to cut ties, to have a winner and a loser. The aim of many dispute settlement systems has been reconciliation. Relationships are complex and multi-stranded. People will have to go on living close to each other and interacting in various ways. It is best that their quarrel is smoothed over rather than settled dramatically in favour of one or the other.